worked something like this. Among the small Southern Paiute groups and the groups of Western Oregon, that among the Southern Paiutes, for instance, they were not asked whether they wanted to be terminated and under what conditions and how they would deal with the world after termination. But they had provided to them, often tacked at the post office in Cedar City and Kanawha and Kanab, Utah, at Barrel Junction, the nature of the Termination Act that would be carried to them, that they could see, that they could disagree with, they could vote on, yes or no. The Southern Paiute were terminated. One little group of Southern Paiute, the Kanawha Band, they had 400 acres after termination. They lost the acres for $160 to unpaid taxes. So there was a sale, and a resident of Southern Utah picked up their 400 acres for $160. One of the more interesting cases in termination. They were one of several Southern Paiute groups that were terminated. The Menominee had the right to vote on the termination legislation that was provided to them, but not to create the bill. The Klamath also was given such a right. A bill was prepared for them. They could vote on it. Some voted to accept it. One man refused. I think that was the first case of a person who absolutely refused to be terminated and to lose his land, and he went in court. He kept his land, and he kept it, I think, in trust status. But at least one Klamath man absolutely refused. Between 1953 and 1962, then, 104 Indian societies were terminated from federal services. Their land was removed from trust status, but they were not denied being a tribe, we find out later. Other Indian societies were frightened by it. And several polls and investigations showed that they all were. They were very uneasy about when the next shoe would drop, when it would be their turn, what would happen to them, what would happen to the societies that they wished to preserve, they wanted to persist. There was a moratorium called on termination about 1955, though the last act, it was enacted in 62. And that's to say that no one did much for a while because of the pressures. And that continued through Kennedy's presidency. Yet the very first commission he sat to investigate termination in Indian affairs for him gave as a bottom line that the goal is termination. So this is not an old idea, a new idea, it's an old idea, and it recurs and it persists. That in 1962, the government still desired, as the final solution to the problem, to terminate Indians from trust status from federal services. During the Johnson administration, through this period of waffling policies and few policies, the War on Poverty brought to reservations the Community Action Project, legal defense projects. It provided expertise to Indians outside of the Bureau of Indian Affairs that had not been available to them beforehand. It showed them in many ways how to deal with welfare offices in their counties and in their states, how to seek rights to which they were entitled, how to deal with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, how to deal with other agencies of the federal government. The Kennedy and the Johnson administrations set off on a program of encouraging, sometimes strong-arming, defense contractors already on the public payroll to move on to Indian reservations and to produce their goods for the defense industry using Indian infrastructure and Indian labor. A few such projects were created. There was also a move through the Commerce Department and then through the Indian desk of the Economic Development Administration to create infrastructures for tribes so that they could draw private industry to reservations, everything from BVD companies to carpet mills. There was little encouragement and no capital for the creation of Indian enterprises. Capital acquisition, information, has always been the problem for the development of Indian enterprises. But to make it a safe place for private enterprise or for defense industry was pushed by the federal government. Practically all of the industrial parks that have been created or that were created in the 60s and early 70s lie out of operation now. I know of no single tribe that has had a fully successful economic development plan. The ones that are usually proposed, I told you that they do have a plan, turn out not to, and that includes the energy-rich societies. The resources from the reservation flow off, and some come back in the form of royalties, lease agreement payments, rights of way payments, other rents. But the large money, the capital that can be accumulated, flows off. Throughout the 1970s, though there was an attempt to develop industry as well as self-government, legislation was not made available that would provide for self-determination. I think that, contrary to what many learned persons have said, the self-determined with determination with reservations that was created during the Collier period actually increased the power of the federal government and was a stronger statement of dependency than the legislation created by the Nixon administration and the Ford administration. It started by the Nixon administration, pushed by the Ford administration thereafter. The Indian Self-Determination Act in particular. Whereas that act really creates for Indians the control of the public sector of their economy, much as the IRA may have done over the long haul, it also provides Indians the control over a private sector if they can get but funds to do it. Some funds are made available through this revolving credit fund, and some agricultural operations and the housing developments have been created on some reservations. It's in a nascent period, but the Indian Self-Determination Act provides for Indians to begin to sever their ties with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and to use the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the same time as a conduit for grants, for entitlements. But it gives them the power to move beyond the Bureau of Indian Affairs and deal with other cabinet-level agencies that have funds for them, to be a granting agency themselves, to seek grants, but also to create tribal enterprises if they could but accumulate the capital and the wisdom against tremendous odds to do so. The Indian Self-Determination Act of 1975 was slow to take hold, but it is taking hold, and I've watched remarkable changes on a few reservations from it, primarily in the way in which Indian leaders deal with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and conduct their own public sector, but they're marked changes nevertheless. Another important recent outcome is the way in which several Indian societies have rejected Court of Claims and Indian Claims Commission settlements. They're so interesting, I've got to read them to you if you don't have them. For those of you who haven't had advantage to look at some of these figures, I want to read them to you. But we'll start at some of the small ones and move up. Beginning about 12 years ago, I've already talked about this this Klamath man, but about 14 years ago, when the California claim was awarded, many, many California Indians from many tribes, from Pitt River in the north to the Coweta in the south, refused the checks that were sent to them as their individual shares. They wanted the land, they claimed the land, they refused to extinguish their title. Of course, the title was extinguished nevertheless, but they did not want and would not take the money. They were not organized in such a fashion as to bring cases, although they tried. I'm not sure that they ever, I don't think they have anything in court now. I could be corrected on that. But after their action, and through a newspaper that had some influence, Wasaha, that was published by Rupert Costo, a Coahuila man from Southern California, and Jeanette Henry, a Cherokee woman. They were somewhat influential, but their attorneys were, the attorneys for these various tribes were very influential in bringing, in causing and aiding and assisting tribes such as the Chippewa from rejecting a $10.15 million claim. The Lake Superior, Mississippi Chippewa from rejecting an $11 million claim. The Northern Paiutes from rejecting a $221,000 claim. The Hopi from rejecting a $5 million claim. Seminole for $16 million. I should say award, not claim. The Western Shoshone for $26 million. And of course, the largest of them all, the Black Hill Sioux, for $106 million. $174 million worth of claims have been refused. They've been refused because the tribes want the land, and they want their cultures, and they want to preserve them, and of course, they want to restore them. So can you have it both ways, preservation and restoration? Sure, preserve what you have and restore what you don't have but want to have. And that has been the claim. This might be interesting to you too. I saw the letter from the Bureau of Indian Affairs to the U.S. Attorney. And they treat each of these claims as if the only problem with any of them is to finally get agreement between Indians residing on reservations and those in cities. And that as soon as you get agreement among them and you have a full list of everybody entitled to the funds, then the awards will be made. That flies right in the face of the evidence from the Shoshone, the Hopi, and the Northern Paiutes, the Sioux, who very strongly have told the U.S. Attorney and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and anybody who will listen that they want the land back. Now, each of these cases is fascinating. Too fascinating, I'm afraid. It's 1225. I'm sorry.
It's 1125, isn't it?
They're fascinating. Okay.
Sorry, your fascinating watch is on Utah time or something.
1125. I am on the California time. Gosh, Utah time, it'd be 1125. We could go for a long time. The Western Shoshone case is an important one. And I don't know what this will do. We'll have to ask Professor Johnson over here what this might do for other cases, or Tim Colder. When the Indian Claims Commission Act was passed, one of the stipulations of the act is that you had to have an identifiable group to get into court, so you know who you're working for, who's claiming what. Are they a tribe? Are they composed? The distinguished firm of Wilkinson, Wilkinson, Cragen, and Barker created a Western Shoshone identifiable group to enter a claim in the Court of Claims. Wilkinson had the first great decision in the Ute case, which the first was for $31 million, the next for $18 million, and so forth. The Western Shoshone identifiable group he had were some members of the Timok band who had him allowed him to take the case to court. Immediately when he did so, and some other Western Shoshones scattered around Utah and Nevada heard about it, they created an association in opposition to it, in opposition to this claims award, because they weren't part of any group that they knew about, and they didn't want to give up their land. Now, here's what's interesting about the case. In 1863, an Indian agent named Doty trotted around Colorado, Idaho, Utah, and Nevada, and he signed entered a series of five treaties. In the last two, one signed in Tooele, Utah, and one still further west, he ceded Utah and Nevada to the tribes, not the other way. The cession it's your land. This is it. I thought that maybe that happened all the time as I studied these things several years ago and was, I didn't know how unique this was, but apparently the Shoshones did. They wanted the land, and so they did not get an attorney immediately. They didn't know how to do that or what steps to take, but they simply formed an organization. And the organization did not want anything to do with the land claims judgment. Eventually, there was an award, and then they knew that they were in trouble. They certainly didn't want an award. Their group had grown and changed its name from the Western Shoshone Association to one of tribal elders who had called themselves the Traditional Council. And the Traditional Council would go to these many, many little rancherias around this area, this vast area of Utah, southern Idaho, parts of a huge hunk of Nevada, and they formed the Western Shoshone Sacred Lands Association. And they got the services of an attorney from New Mexico named Tom Lubin, of a firm Lubin, Hughes, and Tomita. Tomita is an Aleutian woman, an Aleut attorney. Tom Lubin, in behalf of the Western Shoshones, entered two cases into the federal district court. And the first was to enjoin the payment to Wilkinson, Wilkinson, Cragen, and Barker for their fees. And the tribes wanted that done because, as they referred to him, he was practicing law without a client. And they were sore. There was no Shoshone identifiable group. They had met, demonstrated who they were, their genealogy, that the Shoshone identifiable group was not them, and they were the possessors of Utah and Nevada. They also entered a suit where they sought not just the recovery of the land, but they sought all of the rents and all of the payments received by the Bureau of Land Management over 100 years, as they had managed, without the consent of the tribe, tribal land. The United States government thinks they've got a case. And so they're already discussing it out of court, what might the settlement look like. The $26 million has been held aside, and it's accumulating interest. The Shoshones don't want it. They do want their land. And they want their back rents, and if somebody gets funny about offsetting costs and the like, they have other litigation in mind. They've spoken to the Senate Select Committee, and this is one of the things they suggest it might be of interest to us here, that the land be recognized as restored to the tribe, that it not be held in trust status, that it be non-conveyable, and that it be protected under the 1790 Non-Intercourse Act. Yet that they receive back rents and all other payments from the Bureau of Land Management for the federal government for the use of that land. The government has come back with both feet, challenging the two women who were instrumental in getting this going, the Dan sisters, Western Shoshones, but they're tough, and they love the challenge. Usually you sue the government, the government's come after them. And so the battle is joined, and it's moving right along. They're emboldened to do this because of many important decisions that have been made in the past decade, not the least of which was the Menominee Restoration Act, which demonstrated that there's a point at which it doesn't do you an awful lot of good to go to court anymore, because when you go to court, they're liable to tell you that Congress can do anything it wants to do. It has its constitutional authority to do so. But that if you go to Congress after it's agreed you have a case, from time to time you find a willing and helpful Congress that doesn't give you everything that you want, but that wants to see fair play and justice done. And the Menominee Restoration Act, of course, is the bellwether, I think, for the movement in the past few years to provide land through congressional statute to Taos, to Northern Paiutes, to Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, to many others, and that through Congress, legislation is possible to rectify perhaps even the worst problems in ANCSA. That's having a very optimistic look. Yet over the long haul, the history of American Indian legislation, in my jaundiced view, has always been pulled most strongly by individual forces. Deny them group rights because group rights are not fair. Cause them to be like other citizens, responsible for their own actions. They could be successful or they could suffer like the rest of us. Recognize only commodity values and not values that are rather foreign to non-Indians. Whereas an environmental movement has demonstrated that a lot of Europeans would be willing to grant rights to rocks and trees. Rights are usually seen as individual rights, not group rights. And the push has always been to sever and dissociate Indians from their tribes and recognize only commodity rights. Extinguish title, provide money. That goes for navigation rights, water rights, and the price that a person is willing to put on sacred places, on memories of 20 generations residing in the same place, on the desire for 20 more generations to reside on this place, to keep land and culture in perpetuity. With that, I'll close.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jorgensen, very much. We did appreciate that canvas of American history and policy towards Native Americans. I should have said earlier that besides David Case, who will be joining us this afternoon, who is working with the commission, Rosita Worrell, an anthropologist here in Anchorage, well known to many of you, is working with the commission, and she's at the table with us. And I apologize for not mentioning that, Rosita. I was looking at my notes instead of at the table. I was going to call on Ralph Johnson now, and then on Ada Deer, and then, if I may, on Russell Jim, and then Tito Naranjo, and then on Tim Coulter, and perhaps we could proceed in that way. And you carry on, please, Mr. Johnson.
Can I ask first, what time did you want to break for lunch?
Well, maybe 12:10, 12:15, we come back about 1:30, and we have to leave here at 4, because this is the bingo hall, and it works out not badly, actually. It means that we don't convene again in the evening, normally, it means we're still eager to see one another the following morning.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited by the opportunity to participate in this deliberative process, to follow the very fine and articulate presentation on the history and development of federal Indian policy of Joe Jorgensen. I will address the chair as Commissioner Berger, and I believe we can all be grateful that it is Commissioner Berger instead of Justice Berger. I'm sorry I missed the last week's presentation, and I think would have been much informed by it. What I would like to speak to briefly is the question of federal Indian policy, following up what Joe Jorgensen talked about in the lower 48. Two of my former students, Bill Van Ness and David Case, know a great deal more about the Alaska situation, but I've been teaching and working in the field of federal Indian law since about 1968, and I guess because of that, I'm one of the most longest tenured professors of law in the field alive today, which is unusual. It demonstrates how short a time that field has been a field has been a recognized subject for teaching in law schools. That's quite a remarkable fact, that until 1968, 1970, 1972, that subject was not a subject that was taught in the law schools, not either pro or against Indian. It just wasn't taught. It wasn't thought of. Well, it is now. A number of major changes have occurred in the last 12 or 13 years, and while Joe's presentation largely brought us up to the somewhat contemporary time, I would like to concentrate on those things that have occurred really since ANCSA. And the remarkable thing is the amount of energy, the amount of change that has occurred in that period. It is as if things lay dormant with occasionally a major case, Worcester versus Georgia or Kagame or one of the other big name cases or pieces of legislation occurring every 20 or 30 years. Then between 1970 and 1984, you've got the other half of Indian policy. I mean, it's just tremendous grist things that are going on. Every time the Supreme Court of the United States meets, it leaves us sort of astray. We've got to re-examine our basic premises all over again. And I'd like to concentrate on some of the changes that have occurred in that period. I think it's especially significant that ANCSA is being reevaluated now in light of the difference in perceptions that have occurred. And while I would disagree with whoever it was, I hope it wasn't my former student who said that perceptions and ideas were not the most important thing, it seems to me that the perception and the ideas that are created, and that this process that we're now engaged in, that the perceptions and ideas that might be developed and created here will be the most important things. After you get those perceptions and ideas going, then you can hire a lawyer to write them up. But I mean, it's the idea that's the important thing, and that's what we need to worry about. And I'd like to tell you about some of the changes in ideas that have occurred since 1971 in the lower 48. First, as to a few specifics. There have been a number of important United States Supreme Court decisions, substantially a number of these having to do with taxation. The state cannot tax Indians on reservation earned income. The state cannot require reservation automobiles to have state automobile licenses. Indians can tax non-Indian businesses on the reservation, a major decision that confirms some indefinite earlier cases. And Indians can tax non-Indian businesses and the extraction of oil or minerals on the reservation. And the 1969 decision from a somewhat ambivalent Supreme Court of the United States, which confirmed that the Indians have fishing rights and have a right to an opportunity to catch up to 50% of the harvestable fish in the state of Washington. I might add that one of the perceptions that didn't exist in 1970 was that the Indians were entitled to 50% of the fish. That existed in the minds of Russell Jim and a few other people, but the perception did not exist in the legal political community. And somehow that perception became reality, and I can remember going out and giving speeches before the Steelhead Club and other clubs where I was somewhat not welcomed, but they wanted to hear the other side, and on behalf of the Indians, and I would get criticized as being way too far over there. Well, ultimately, when the case was decided, it was way beyond me. I mean, it said 50%, and in fact, it is almost surprising that the Indians didn't get 70 or 80 or 90%, which is what they were catching in 1855 to 1900. A perception change. One of the major perceptual changes that occurred in the 1970s is the exercise of governmental power by Indian tribes in the lower 48. There were many latent powers of government that were around there somewhere. They were not being exercised. Now, during the 1970s, they began to realize that these were powers that were there, they should be exercised, and the courts have said, the Supreme Court as well, have said that the lack of exercise of those powers, it's essentially a vacuum, the state moves in, or somebody moves in. When the tribe exercises those powers, then it becomes a factual reality that the states must accommodate to. If you look at the tribal codes, for example, of the Yakima and the Menominee and a number of the other tribes that have moved ahead more aggressively, you see very substantial civil and criminal codes that have been developed in those periods. They're now being developed all over the western United States and the reservations. Because those codes now reflect the multitude of activities that tribal governments are legitimately engaged in. Of course, there were some lost battles, too, and that is the Oliphant case in which Indian tribes or discovered by the Supreme Court as not having jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction, I specify, criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, and the cigarette tax cases, which denied to the Indians important sources of revenues for tribal government. One of the important perceptual changes, though, that occurred in that period was that the Major Crimes Act and Public Law 280 probably only bestow concurrent jurisdiction, and they leave the tribes with jurisdiction that they had before. The basic rule of statutory construction is that Indian sovereignty will not be denied unless Congress explicitly or clearly says it will be denied. Well, there's nothing in the Major Crimes Act that says anything about the fact that tribes are to lose their sovereign power to punish people for crimes. It simply adds, it's a major crime, it becomes a federal crime for an Indian to do something. That does not mean that the tribe loses its jurisdiction over Indians. So that leaves the tribe with concurrent jurisdiction over major crimes. I can develop some of these ideas further later. I don't want to go into the detail of them at the present time. The same thing with Public Law 280. There seems to be a widespread assumption in Alaska, in some of the literature I've read, that when the state assumed exclusive PL 280 jurisdiction, assumed PL 280 jurisdiction, it was exclusive. That's not true in the lower 48. There is a widespread perception now, in the last 7 or 8 years, that the most that the states got was somehow concurrent jurisdiction, leaving the tribes with all the jurisdiction they had before, which I should add, and I hope we can develop, is a much better situation to be in. Another very important case that came out recently, in 1981, the United States Supreme Court decided Montana versus United States, and in a sense, although the Crow tribe lost the case, and it looked like a bad case for Indians, the way it is being interpreted by the lower federal courts seems to be just the reverse. It seems to say, for example, that Indians have the power to zone, to control water use, to control building regulations, health regulations, all those things. The case has very important language in it. It is a recognition of tribal sovereign power in civil matters over non-Indians. In civil matters over non-Indians, even on fee patent, fee simple land on the reservation. Another thing that has occurred during this period of time, and a very important event it seems to me, is that the Indian judges, the Indian courts, have organized into a National American Indian Court Judges Association. About 200 tribal judges have organized and have a training program that is unmatched in the non-Indian society anywhere, for non-lawyers. Now, there are lawyer training programs. Most of the Indian judges are non-lawyers, just the same as about 10,000 non-Indian judges are not lawyers. But the Indian training program under the National American Indian Court Judges Association is a sophisticated, highly developed, highly articulated training program. Each one of the judges has an average of about 18 to 20 days of training each year. It's a model that could be looked at for many other places. There's another aspect, another perceptual change that has occurred. There's been a lot of talk in the literature and in the background papers about IRA tribes, the IRA organization. One of the interesting phenomena that's occurring in the lower 48 is that many tribes which were and are IRA tribes are pulling back from that and are asserting inherent sovereignty as the source by which they develop new laws by which they operate their courts. By that I mean this, that under the IRA they were required to get secretarial approval for amendments to Constitution and sometimes for their amendments to their codes. They are now saying, we don't have to have your authority. We operate on the basis of inherent sovereignty. It was always there. When we became an IRA tribe, we did not give up inherent sovereignty. We simply complied with a federal rule that said you get certain powers if you do this. What that means and what that has meant is that the Secretary of the Interior no longer, in those cases, has the power to say no or yes or anything else with regard to the change in a tribal constitution or code, with the exception of tribal trust property, where the United States holds the property in trust for the tribe, then the tribe does not have the legal power to go ahead and change their code except by the consent or the participation of the Secretary of the Interior. But in all other aspects of tribal government, they need no longer go to the Secretary of Interior for approval. That is a little known fact. It is, though, part of the infrastructure of what is going on in the tribal governance in the lower 48. A number of pieces of important legislation have occurred during the 1970s. You've heard some of them mentioned here, the Self-Determination Act of 1975, the very important Indian Child Welfare Act, a major perception of Congress that something was wrong in the way that the society, the welfare agencies were dealing with adoptions and custody problems with Indian children, and they enacted it into federal law. And an area that is traditionally been very, very local has now been usurped, preempted by federal policy. The American Indian Religious Freedom Act, another act that is important, and then lastly and most recently, the Indian Tribal Government Tax Status Act, which gives Indian tribes a status for tax purposes, a favorable status, much like state government. There's another very interesting perception that has occurred in the 1970s. It goes along with the idea that there weren't any law school courses in that before 1970, and that is that Indian tribes have discovered lawyers. They've discovered how you fight legal battle, how you fight battles in this society. We're a very litigation-oriented, courtroom-oriented, and legislation-oriented society. You use lawyers. You watch how the Indian tribes in the lower 48 are able to utilize the expertise of lawyers, give them direction, give them conviction, ask them to do this. They are the protagonists in this society, whether they're Indian or not. I mean, they are the people that move the pieces in the right direction. And that has been a major change. One of the things that has gone along with that has been the Indian Law Center training program of the University of New Mexico. Before 1968, I've never seen any responsible figures, but I would guess there were probably less than 25 or 50 Indian lawyers in the United States. The training program in New Mexico has generated hundreds of Indian lawyers, many, almost all of which have gone back and have some association with Indian tribes around the country or with legal services programs around. So there's a major infusion of Indian lawyers capable of handling Indian questions with really personal knowledge and cultural background. A major difference. There's another specific thing that I'd like to mention, and I would hope that possibly Ada Deer will comment on it further, and that is in the restoration of the Menominee Reservation, which is again a reaffirmation of sovereignty principles that has occurred during this period of the 1970s. One particular thing that should be noted, and that is the Menominees went from a stock ownership situation back to a reservation and trust relationship situation, and it did not raise, or at least it has not, and I'm satisfied it won't, constitutional questions that might have been raised in that situation. I think it is a precedent by which if Congress decided to go back and change the situation of individual stock ownership, it could do so without any affront to the constitutional principles. More fundamental questions are being asked in the last 5 years or so, and Tim Coulter and others will comment on those, and especially next week we'll hear more about them, about whether the legal system in the United States is adequate to handle the change in notion and perception and idea that is critical to Indian future in this country. Should we be looking more to international agencies, to international organizations of one sort and another? And it seems to me very clear that we should be working on both of those fronts. We should be working in the courts, should be working in Congress, we should be working in those international agencies. Very important new ideas are coming out of those efforts. Well, I hope that we can discuss many of these points in detail. I've just touched on them very, very quickly here. It's a pleasure to be here and participate in this process. Thank you.
I'm just going to ask you, Mr. Johnson, before we move on, do you have any comment on what Mr. Jorgensen said about the Shoshone's proposal for, I think, establishing
ensuring that the land is inalienable, but yet not subject to trust supervision. That's what they're trying to do, I think. Did you catch that, or do you have any comment on it?
I heard what he said, and I have, and of course, as I understand, you're suggesting that Congress would take some action to do this, and I have no doubt about what that's within the power of Congress to do, but I don't know the particular, I don't have any particular feeling on it. Obviously, one of the questions that would have to be confronted is like the main land claims, Passamaquoddy and Penobscot cases, and that is the existence of villages and towns and farms that are now presumably owned or claimed by non-Indians. And of course, they resolve that there by saying we're interested in the federally owned lands or lands owned by large timber companies, at least, and not places that are owned by cities and towns. But there shouldn't be any inherent difficulty in making an accommodation of that sort.
The just one comment that I have. Mr. Van Ness, who spoke last week, regards ANCSA as a great success. That is the language that he used. And I think he was looking at ANCSA from the same point of view as Mr. Hundorf, president of Cook Inlet Regional Corporation, whose views I read from the article he wrote in the Anchorage Times. And I think it was that led Mr. Van Ness to say, well, all that's needed is to make a few changes in the way the thing works. And that's why I think he felt we were perhaps paddling all over a vast ocean of ideas here, and it wasn't altogether necessary. But I think that is a perception that Mr. Hundorf and Mr. Van Ness hold, and there's another perception that I thought
I might
reflected.
To that, if I could, and that is that no discredit to Mr. Van Ness, he's a very bright, able person, but he was one of the principal architects of ANCSA as the staff of Senator Jackson at the time, and obviously has an interest in having a success in something that he worked so hard at and tried so very hard to make into a successful product. But I don't think there's any doubt but what ANCSA was concerned at that time, and this goes back to the history that existed in 1970-71, Indian governance was not the major thing that was in the mind